Part 2. Burning Empire. Chapter 5. Echidon. He breathed and closed his eyes for a second. Blood ran down his face and shoulders. There had not been time for it to clot. His hearts were already settling into a low, steady rhythm. It was one thing that he thought he missed of humanity. The feeling of exertion, the breathlessness, the hammer of a single heartbeat in his chest. The gene ascension that remade a man into a warrior of the legions had stolen that. He opened his eyes. The remains of 15 combat servitors lay around him. Blood oozed from their meat and oil from their machine grafts. All of them had been fresh conversions, made with good strong stock from the slave chaff held in the lower decks. All of them had been killers of the type bred by situations in which one needed to be a predator, lest one became the prey. The Mechanicum had left them their full motor function, and the parts of the brain that held their combat instincts. Aggression enhancers, crude nerve grafting, and weapon implants had pushed their abilities past the point of effectiveness into a realm of inhuman slaughter. He had demanded no less from the tech priests, and they had supplied in full. Still, he had to confess that he found the result disappointing. Others might favour sword or bolter, or an axe like that in his hand, but the knife was the soul of a killer. That was the Chthonian lesson, one that had been delivered by the muffled cries of the dying in dark tunnels during another life. It was a remnant of the world that had borne him, and the brief childhood that had shaped him. It had a truth. Only the brother in blood who had come with him into the Legion at his side was, perhaps, better at this way of murder. He rolled his shoulders and padded across the chamber, bare feet splashing in the puddles of blood and oil. He put the axe back on the weapon rack, activating its power field briefly to burn the blood from its blade. He was bare to the waist, and the tattoos and brands covering his skin stretched as he tensed and released each one in turn. The marks were mainly geometric, the jagged lines of Chthonia's gang language. It was not a sophisticated tongue, but you didn't need sophistication when your main purpose was to threaten. In the gloom, or total dark, of Chthonia's tunnels, it was meant to be read as much by touch as by eye, the marks gouged deep into stone or metal by blade tip. It was a language of cuts made by murderers. Callus Echidon found that amusing, as often as he found it appropriate. He looked at the weapon rack. He was a good killer, always had been. It was something that had come easily to him as a child, that had kept him alive and then given him everything he knew. Pride, status, such as that was, and brotherhood had all come from the edge of his blade or the muzzle of his gun. He stepped away from the rack and drew his dagger from its thigh sheath. A power field generator sat at the base of the blade, but otherwise it was the same weapon that he had brought from Chthonia. Straight-bladed, narrow-tipped, razor-sharp on one side, with a blood-fuller running beside its blunt back. A mirror coin had been beaten into the pommel, and then burnished smooth. He flicked it between fore and reverse grip, then opened his mouth to call the next wave of servitors. The doors to the practice chamber clanged as their locks released. Echidon turned as they began to pull wide. Falcus Kyber walked through them. The humming vibration of his Terminator plate shivered along Echidon's nerves as he watched the Widowmaker advance towards him. He did not move, and kept his face composed in its habitual half-sneer. "Brother," said Kyber, coming to a halt. Even without the Terminator armor, Kyber was a huge man. With it, he was a mountain of jet surfaces and blunt edges.
"Falcus," said Echidon. "You're overdressed, if you came to test your skill."
Kyber gave a short growl that might have been a laugh, and walked past Echidon, boots crushing the corpses of the servitors to pulp. He walked around the training pit, head turning as he glanced at the remains.
"You are worried that you are losing your edge, brother," said Kyber at last,
nudging a severed head with the tip of his boot.
"An edge is only worth something if you keep it sharp," said Echidon.
"Truth," barked Kyber. "Truth."
He nodded at the knife in Echidon's hand.
"You did this with that?"
Echidon shook his head.
"Well, this is for the next batch.
You like your childhood toys, don't you, brother? I heard that you tried to kill the warrior who tried to take it from you on Chthonia when you were recruited. Story says he lost an eye to you."
"He didn't,"
said Echidon.
"Just a story, then," said Kyber. "Who was it that picked you out of the tunnels? Sejanus? The half-herd?"
"You know who it was,"
said Echidon carefully. Kyber's eyes moved back to the knife in Echidon's hand and flicked up to where the silver cord held the pierced obsidian disc against his forearm. The whirl of feathers, claws, and eyes cut into the disc were invisible in the gloom of the training chamber, but he knew they were there, an echo of the pattern in his dreams. He had tied it there while he trained, and would hang it back around his neck later. Its weight and touch against his skin was still unfamiliar.
"Loyalty," said Kyber, hefting the word deliberately. "These are difficult times. Testing times."
Echidon heard the weight placed on the word.
"You mean your dispute with Malachist?"
He felt a flare of pleasure as Kyber blinked.
"I'm not of the Mournivale, brother, but I wear the same black as you. We're first company. We guard and watch, and we hear."
"He cannot be trusted," said Kyber.
Echidon raised an eyebrow above his habitual sneer.
"The Warmaster trusts him."
Kyber clenched his teeth and then let out a long breath.
"The Warmaster, in his withdrawal, cannot trust or condemn. We must do that for him. We are his guardians."
Echidon kept his eyebrow raised.
"And Abaddon? What would our first captain say?"
"He is far away, but he would agree."
He paused.
"Baxaman agrees."
"Tormageddon?"
asked Echidon.
"What does the creature think? Has it chosen a side? Because that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Sides chosen, lines drawn. He wants to use some sorcery to try to what? Revive the Warmaster? Then you and Axemen think that the sorcerous ways taught by the likes of Erebus and Lorgar are suspect, and that the Warmaster will recover."
Kyber did not answer. Echidon grinned, the gesture wide and humorless.
"You don't trust me. You do not know if I would be with you if you gave the order to spill Malachurst's guts onto the deck, do you?"
He sneered and flicked the knife into the air. It spun as it fell. He caught it, threw it again and caught it in the other hand, then threw it up again, grinning, the knife tumbling and glinting.
"We're all murderers and betrayers, haven't you heard, brother? I have 207 personal kills between Istvan and Beta Garmon to prove that I should never be trusted."
"This is serious, brother," growled Kyber.
"So am I,"
said Echidon, catching the knife between forefinger and thumb as it flashed past. He held it steady.
"I'm captain of the Reavers. I wear the black of the First Company. I am bloodied many times over. I have stood at our Warmaster's side, at your side, and have never hesitated to kill at our Lord's will. What is there that you would question in that?"
"Your lodge."
Kyber said the word as though he were chewing something bitter and sharp. Echidon laughed and turned away.
"It's not a lodge, brother. The days of the lodge have gone, its purpose served. Surely you remember, or perhaps you cannot say."
He loaded the old words of secrecy with mockery and saw the Widowmaker's eyes flash. He let his own satisfaction bleed into his grin.
"We were both there, and we both know the truth now,"
There are no lodges. No Erebus pulling the strings to his own design. We're all of the one lodge now. And that lodge is the Legion of the Warmaster.
He widened his grin, showing the black and silver runes set into his teeth.
All the rest are dead.
Your Cathartidae, began Kyber.
There have always been brotherhoods amongst warriors, even as far back as Chthonia. You must remember that, yeah? The Cathartidae do not follow me. They don't follow anyone. They follow principles, will and strength and power. It's about the individual, not the whole. You see, it's not even a secret. I would offer to induct you, but I think it might not suit your tastes.
Kyber held his gaze steady on Ekadon's grin for a long moment, and then shook his head.
I should have killed you a long time ago, he said.
You should have tried, said Ekadon.
Then at least we would not have to have this conversation.
Both of them had gone very still. Ekadon was still grinning, Kyber's sunken eyes dark and unblinking. Then the Widowmaker laughed, the sound like a gunshot, his armoured bulk growling as he half turned away, shaking his head.
Oaths in blood, but you make it easy to dislike you, he said.
Ekadon bowed his head.
One of my many gifts, he said. But you came here to find out if I would stand with you. If you and Malachurst and Axeman decide to tear the Legion apart. If you still want an answer, here it is. I don't care. I don't care if Malachurst is right or you are. If Axeman agrees or does not. I don't care. It's your fight, not mine. Just like back on Chthonia.
Ekadon shrugged.
Just like that. If it comes to it, are you with us or with the Twisted One? I stand where I always have. With myself and with Lupercal, said Ekadon, shaking his head. But you, brother, if you decide that everyone who is not for you is against you, then you will have even fewer friends than you do already.
Kyber raised his chin slightly.
Malachurst says that he is helping the Warmaster, and his designs and sorceries are needed. Those words would not move you to think that path worth supporting?
Now it was Ekadon's turn to laugh.
You know me better than that, Falcus. Captain Kyber, he snarled,
but then nodded.
And yes, I suppose I do. Just make sure that it stays that way. You've always been a good soldier, Kallus.
Falcus Kyber turned and walked out of the training circle, the grinding purr of his armour receding into the shadows. Ekadon watched the captain of the Justerin go, and then turned back to the empty circle of the practice chamber. He rolled his shoulders, feeling muscle loosen.
Repeat previous training parameter,
he said, and heard the control servitors clatter in response.
Increase combat servitor aggression to maximal. Compliance,
said the control servitor. Ekadon flicked the knife between his hands. Kyber had always been a sharp but straightforward soul. He had accepted Ekadon's answer, but had not thought to ask the question that really mattered. 15 combat servitors clanked forwards. Chain blades gunned to life. Power flails and piston spears rose. The question was not what Ekadon believed was right, or who was right. He did not care. The question was, what would give him what he wanted?
Activate,
he growled, and the servitors charged. Lyak. Orcus was a violated world. It had never been beautiful. Once, clouds had swirled across much of the scrubland of its surface. Its seas and oceans had been the sullen black of poisoned wine. Ice had capped its poles, which extended their cold grasp down to touch the mountain ranges with bitter winds. Human colonists had found it in one of the measureless epochs of old night. Orcus was not kindly to its adoptive children. All that remained of the generations who had tried to make a life on its surface were tiny clutches of humanity living in dread of unspecified fears. When the Great Crusade had found it, the iterators had been able to discover that the ragged fur-clad humans believed they lived on the edge of the realm of the dead, that they were cursed. They were right, of course. Looking at the surface of Orcus rise towards him, Lyak wondered if the bearers of the Imperial Truth had ever paused to ask themselves if those that they tried to illuminate already saw the truth perfectly. Orcus was a world on the edge of another realm. Now it lay amongst the heavens like a shattered skull on the battlefield of forgotten gods. Continent-sized fires had flayed the forests from its surface. Thermic charges had turned the ice caps to steam. Rolling clouds of grey ash were its shroud. The mountains alone remained, clawing at the lightning-threaded murk. Void stations ringed it, and ships laboured through the dust-filled void around it to bring pilgrim warriors to feed its dark mouth. "Did the burning of this place have a point beyond ritual devotion?" asked Lyak, as the grey swirl of Orcus's atmosphere rushed up towards their descending shuttle barge. "Lord," he added.
"It is beautiful, don't you think?"
said Lorgar.
"There are those amongst your brothers who have looked on this place and said that they can feel the breath of the gods on their faces."
"Yes," said Lyak, forming the word carefully. He had felt strange ever since Lorgar had told him what role he would play in the plan to replace Horus as Warmaster. "They are blessed," he finished.
"You have never beheld the doors to the labyrinth ways, have you?"
said Lorgar, as the view beyond the shuttle barge's arched windows became a swirling sheet of grey.
"I have never been so honoured," said Lyak.
"It is something. Perhaps it will move even your soul."
"Perhaps, Lord."
Lorgar looked at him, eyes unblinking. Lyak's mask contracted over his face. Iron hooks pulled red tears from his cheeks. He returned the Primarch's gaze. Besides the two of them, only Lyak's blade slave shared the shuttle barge's hold. The space could have held 50 legionaries in full armour, but Lorgar had ordered that they travel to the door between worlds alone.
"Watch," said Lorgar,
turning his gaze back to the view beyond the ashen clouds. The shuttle barge fired altitude thrusters, and its flight levelled out. The clouds thinned. A splintered spike of black stone loomed out of the gloom. The shuttle barge slewed around the finger of stone. Stab lights lit on its hull and sliced down. Suddenly, the clouds around them were gone, the unbroken layer above seeming like a lid nailed over the sky. Clear air dropped away below. Flashes of lightning revealed the sheer flanks of black mountains rising around them as they dropped lower. Black rain fell in an unending deluge. The shuttle barge turned, passing between two cliff faces. Lyak caught the glimmer of fires burning somewhere in the wide bowl beyond. The craft cleared the gap between the mountains, and the ground fell away, and kept falling. Despite himself, Lyak felt a jolt of vertigo. Blackness extended in front of his eyes, down and down without end. A wound lay open in the skin of the planet. Explosives and stone burners had scooped away half a mountainside, leaving a tapered shaft wide enough to swallow a battleship. Fused crystals glittered in the smooth walls. Huge metal gantries spiraled down the hole. Webs of girders and cables held them to the glass-smooth rock. Torch towers dotted the gantries, streaming white-hot flames into the rain-laden dark. The corpses of sacrifices hung from chains beneath platforms. The structures that covered their tops looked to have been made from the flesh of the mountain. Temples, armories, storehouses, all of their roofs scrawled with words incised into the black stone. But Lyak could see that the darkness descended far below the deepest structure. As he watched, lightning earthed on the wall of the shaft and whipped down its walls. For a second, he had the impression of a tongue flicking out of the mouth of a great beast. The shuttle barge fired thrusters to hold station above the drop, then began to descend. The torch towers breathed blue-hot flames in salute. The buildings on the gantries grew larger, and Lyak realized that the abyss beneath them had stolen their scale. These were fanes and muster halls that could house maniples of titans, or tens of thousands of troops. This was a way station on the road to the alien dimension known as the Webway. War machines, soldiers, and materiel came here, were blessed by the priests of the primordial truth, and then went down into the dark of the labyrinth realm. The breach into the Webway had not been made by the word-bearers. It was old, a remnant of a war between ancient races, now long dead. But the gods remembered, and their demons had guided Lorgar to Orcus, as well as to other worlds where the doors between worlds could be forced open again. Some gates had been drowned under oceans. Deserts and the bones of dead cities had surrounded others. Alien jungles had grown up around the door on Lassil 10, strangling it in meter-thick creepers. On Orcus, the doorway had waited in darkness, far beneath the light of the land above, waited and dreamed strangeness into the world. Then Lorgar had found it, and his servants had bored a hole through mountains straight into its mouth. Lyak realized that Lorgar was watching him as they slid down to the lowest platform circling the shaft.
"Magnificent, is it not?" said the Primarch.
The shuttle barge jerked as its landing thrusters fired. It slewed around and settled onto a wide platform jutting from the shaft wall. The doors down the side of the barge hinged up. Wind gusted in, carrying the smell of rain and ash. Lyak expected to see a waiting throng of supplicants on the landing pad. Such things followed Lorgar like a shadow, but instead there were just 10 figures, swathed and hooded in crimson, standing in a semicircle. Raindrops hissed a meter from them, exploding to steam in midair. A heat haze shimmered around them, blurring and folding their shapes. Some were tall and rake-thin, others squat and bulging beneath their robes. Some seemed almost human. All blazed in the rune-spun sight of Lyak's mask. Whispers of countless languages breathed in his ears as he looked at them. For the first time in a long time, he felt himself pause. They were the oracles of the Ashen Saint. All of them were sacred augurs who revered the Blessed Lady and who read the tides of the warp. They existed under the protection of the Primarch and were esteemed almost as highly as the lost saint of the Pantheon. Few amongst the Legion had ever seen the Weeping Ones, as some called them. Lyak had never encountered them himself and had thought them an indulgence of sentiment. Now he realized he had made an error. The Crimson Ten bowed as Lorgar walked towards them. All other mortals would have knelt and pressed their faces into the wet stone of the platform. These simply hinged their cowled heads down for 3 heartbeats, and then raised them again.
"Holiness," said a voice from amongst the 10.
It sounded female to his ears, but cracked and folded with harmonics that made the wards etched into the inside of his armor burn.
"Your coming was breathed into the blood of the dying, and your will is writ on the storm's light."
"Favorable omens," said Lorgar.
"Omens good and ill are all the same when seen from eternity."
Lorgar gave a small smile.
"Quite so," he said.
"I do not recognize your voice. To whom do I speak?" The figure did not answer, but turned her hooded head towards Lyak. He felt himself tense.
You bring your hollow man with you, said the voice.
Lyak felt his mask's inner hook's bite, and its silver fangs lengthen like a predator snarling at a rival.
He will be my companion as I cross the threshold.
What do you seek?
Asked the hooded figure, looking back to Lorgar.
I seek my lost brother. I seek the angel of excess that was Fulgrim.
The Crimson Ten hissed, heads swaying beneath red velvet. Ghost auras flared from them in Lyak's sight, shimmering in grey confusion and blue fear. Some raised their arms. Lyak glimpsed long fingers and parchment-white skin.
The chosen of perfection,
said one of the tallest of the figures. Its voice was high and brittle, like the scratching of glass edges.
To walk such a path, to begin it.
I know that only a few may pass on such a journey.
That is why I bring only a few.
I have read the augurs too. I will need a guide.
Of course, Lord Aurelian,
said the figure that had first spoken, and it raised its hands to drop its hood. The head beneath was shaved bare, the features young, female, and unmarked by scars. Soot tattoos ringed her eyes and flowed down her cheeks in ragged tears, and the eyes themselves were cataract white. Power burned from them. Lyak realized she was blind. There was a pause as the two faced each other.
I do not know you, said Lorgar. And Lyak thought there was doubt warring with certainty in the Primarch's voice.
How can even you know all that serve at your will? Said the blind woman. I am called Actea. I am the oracle of this door. I will walk with you and be your guide.
Lyak felt as though Lorgar would dispute it, but then the moment faded and he nodded.
We are blessed, he said.
Perhaps,
said Actea.
It has not been written.
Volk. Perturabo watched the flow of cold data from the heart of the Iron Blood. Screens hung from the ceiling around him. Tactical information scrolled across them in an endless cascade. These were not displays that turned details into maps and readouts. This was primary data from across the Iron Blood's fleet. Engine outputs, gun charge readiness, position error margins, crew status. All of it was passing over the screens, undiluted and unmediated. Perturabo had been absorbing it all for an hour, only his eyes moving. Occasionally, the arrangement of the screens would alter, but the Lord of Iron remained still at their centre. His iron circle automata surrounded him in a loose ring. Green sensor beams flicked from their eyes, washing back and forth over their surroundings. Volk had come from the surface after his final ground action on the slopes of the mountain. Trench dirt still clung to the scratches in his armour, at odds with the sterile surroundings. He had stood in the Iron Blood Strategium only once before. Then, as now, he was struck by the quiet. Others, who saw the Legion as the breakers of fortresses and heard the iron in their name as the roar of cannons, would have been surprised at the peace of this place. The chamber was circular, its floor tiered so that the banks of system controls rose from the open space at the centre to a domed roof of bare metal. Hundreds of servitors sat in cradles of tubes and wires, their skin grey from years spent in perpetual gloom. Black uniformed serfs moved silently amongst them. Here and there, tech priests in white robes bent over control panels, metal hands clicking softly as they tapped keys and adjusted dials. All of them carried out their tasks with barely a word. The chamber was buried deep in the Iron Blood's hull, its corridors watched by slaved gun nests and cybernetica maniples. On other ships, the place of command would have been the bridge. The light of stars would have fallen through huge viewports. But not on the Iron Blood. Even before the first engagements of the war, Perturabo had kept the interior of the ship sealed from the view of the void beyond. Part of that was purely practical. Viewports were points of weakness in the hull and afforded no advantage in battle. Their absence also focused the mind. "Everything that you need to see is before you," it said. "Let nothing distract you from it." The last reason, Volk suspected, was a lesson taught by siegecraft and retaught by the last decade of fighting warriors who possessed the same base capabilities as the Fourth Legion. A typical bridge, high on the hull of a ship, was too easy a target.
"All elements are in place," said Perturabo,
his voice low but carrying across the chamber.
"Begin the first phase."
"By your will,"
came the reply from the serfs. The hum of control systems blended with the murmur of the crew passing orders. The vibrations of the ship were a bass note that rose through Volk's feet. He had tried to read and collate the data passing before Perturabo, but he had eventually had to admit defeat. There was simply too much. He had risen through the Legion's hierarchy and passed through layers of mental conditioning that allowed him to function at levels of tactical complexity that would break most mortal minds. But this was like trying to drink from a waterfall. He could read generalities and hazy impressions of the reality in the void outside the ship, but that was all. Argonis removed his helmet and locked it to his belt. The light of the data screens flickered in his eyes. Volk could tell that the emissary was about to speak.
"You wish to see what the War Master's command has brought about," said Perturabo,
his head turning to look at Argonis. His skin was parchment pale, drawn tight over the skull beneath. His armor hissed as hidden pistons flexed like muscles. Argonis nodded. Perturabo gestured. A cone of light sprang into being. Crade and its system glowed green in the projection. A spiral of ships extended from the planet's northern pole, each also marked in green. The enemy war fleet held off, watching and waiting to see what the Lord of Iron was doing. Sensor data ringed each of the enemy ships. Most were medium-tonnage warships crewed by humans. Two were behemoths of the void. The Acrisas and the Nebula-born were both warbarks of the Cassini dynasty, exiled lords of the Jovian void clans returned from the edge of the galactic rim. Beside these hung the serrated barb of a lone Legiones Astartes cruiser. The Consul of Eternity gleamed with bronze plating, and the symbol of the Ultramarines sat above its prow, clutched in the claws of a silver hawk. It was a considerable force, not enough to blockade a world, but more than enough to dispute one. Volk took in the display, his eyes moving over the clusters of enemies, assimilating the position. Argonis spoke his thoughts out loud.
"That is the dagger of Orion,"
said the emissary, nodding at the deployment pattern of the enemy ships.
"The Ultramarines are cautious, but they will strike once it is clear what our ships intend."
"You are a scholar of Void War, as well as an ambassador," said Perturabo. "Tell me then, what would you do to break clear of the system?"
Argonis did not hesitate.
"Send two substantive forces running for the inner reaches of the system. Draw them to counter, and then advance your fleet directly at those trying to contain you. Concentrate strikes and burn at maximum speed to break through."
"Simple and direct," rasped Perturabo. "I can almost taste the Chthonian ash in it."
Perturabo's eyes narrowed as they turned from the emissary to the screens of data.
"But Gilliman's dogs stand against us. And while they are many things, they are not fools."
He breathed and raised a hand. The weapon pod on its back vented cooling gas in a hissing exhalation. His fingers opened with a melody of smooth gears. The thrum of distant engines increased. On the display, The marker of the iron blood began to move.
They have already theorized that part of the fleet might be trying to break out.
Signals and data markers sparkled amongst the Iron Warrior ships.
They have already made allowance for that fact.
The Iron Blood's fleet was accelerating. The spiral formation of the ships began to rotate faster.
Your plan would still work. We would still break through. Casualties would be almost identical to those we shall sustain.
Falk watched as the enemy elements began to respond. Ordnance launch warnings flashed beside the clusters of ships. In his mind, he heard the roar as torpedoes kissed the void and engines flared to full power. In the strategium, all was silence, and the distant growl of plasma reactors sounded like the echo of gathering thunder.
An adequate solution, said Perturabo, but one that misses the point.
Weapon and full battle readiness icons flashed through the Iron Warrior's fleet.
There are four elements to our force. One remains here to hold the void for as long as the battle on the surface lasts. Two are battle fleets that will make for Mondus Kraton and Numinos, and from there travel through the Beta Garmon breach to the muster at Ullinor.
Lord Perturabo,
called a tactical serf from the tiers of system stations.
All elements await your word.
Perturabo did not shift his gaze from Argonis. The emissary returned it unblinking.
Do you know what the true nature of iron is? Even when still, even when it is a lump of ore in the ground, iron dreams, for it knows its purpose.
He looked at the serf who had spoken a second before. He nodded.
That purpose is to cut.
The serf turned, gesturing to her underlings.
To crash, said Perturabo, in a voice that rasped like a whetstone on a keen edge.
Orders crackled across the vox. The scads of data reflected in Perturabo's eyes flickered and began to flow faster.
To break.
The holo display was rotating, the view broadening. The entirety of the Iron Warrior's fleet was dropping into formation around and behind the Iron Blood as the vast capital ship accelerated. The enemy ship groups were moving too, burning on attack vectors, sliding against the stars so that they could plunge down into the mass of the Iron Warrior's ships like hawks through a flock of doves. But they were moving too slowly, and Falk could tell that in their theoretical projections, the commanders had assumed that a force would remain close to Kraid, that even if they came in strength, the Iron Warriors would not come as a whole, that they could not cohere as fast as they had.
I have always admired Chthonian directness, said Perturabo.
His gaze again locked on Argonis as the glow of battle data flared and shifted behind him.
The spear thrust, the single strike which ends all conflict. But a spear thrust is only as good as the target it strikes at.
You're not withdrawing from the system,
began Argonis. Volk's gust of laughter cut him off. Volk looked at the Primarch, biting back the cold humour that had risen in him as he realised what they were doing. Perturabo glanced at him, and in the lightless depths of the Primarch's gaze, he saw a flicker of something he had not seen in a long time. A connection. A moment of shared understanding so strong that for that instant he felt that his next thought was an echo of Perturabo's own.
You do not see, brother, said Volk. You think that our only purpose is to follow your order, that we are swords to be wielded and then put down.
The mass of the Iron Warrior's fleet was pushing forwards. A shot cannon blast fired at where the Ultramarine's warship moved with its shoal of escort craft. The Iron Blood Sisters spread in a wide cone around it. Fire began to shiver across the holo projection. Shield data values decremented. Ammunition expenditure surged.
But we are not tools to be used, said Forex,
coming to stand next to Volk. The enemy fleet was reacting. Fire lashed into outer elements of the Iron Warrior's formation. Ships died, shields crumpled, hulls split and gushed fire and light into the dark. But the Iron Blood cut on, the distance between it and the Consul of Eternity shrinking.
Our iron is in our blood, not in our blades.
They were losing ships. They were suffering. But none of that mattered. As Volk watched the Ultramarines' ships spiral and pour fire at them, he knew that there were Legion brothers dying there that were just splinters of light set before his eyes.
Why?
Asked Argonis, as the Consul of Eternity began to burn under the fire of five warships. Perturabo did not answer for a moment. He was watching as the casualty values rose.
Because we were made to build, but now we exist to destroy.
Then he raised a hand, and with a flick, the screens of data were blank, and the air, where the hollow projection had been, empty.
Send the order for the fleet elements to separate and translate to the warp as soon as we are past the system threshold.
Our course?
Asked Argonis, as Perturabo turned and moved towards the chamber's doors. The Iron Circle turned their green gazes on the emissary. Fine gears clicked and whirred in their arms as they shifted posture fractionally. Volk was reminded of the muscles flexing in a warrior's sword arm. Argonis's face remained impassive.
Where are we bound?
He called.
Even Angron's wild dogs need bullets and armor, said Forex. So we go to the forge that feeds them.
Sarum, said Perturabo without turning.
We are going to the cradle of the Dragons of War.